Get in, losers. We're watching It, Welcome to Derry, and we are here on episode 4, halfway through season 1. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. So yeah, we're halfway through, right? There's 8 episodes in this first season, correct?
We are halfway. This is the midpoint. I think things are heating up in Derry. It's been a little bit of a slow burn. It's a slower burn than we're used to with the It adaptation because there's not that zeal to cram everything in all at once. But we get a little bit of Pennywise history in this chapter.
We do. We got a little glimpse of the clown in the last week's episode. And I guess you can say we see an outline of a clown. There's a shadow clown that's spying on little Will Hanlon at a certain point. But it's we get a lot more It, but not much more Pennywise, which we'll see if the audience has the patience to go through some of this backstory. But there's a lot of moving pieces. I feel like this is a setting pieces up episode. There's lots of things that are being moved into place in this episode with some pretty grotesque imagery, I got to say. But we'll dive all into that in a second.
Literally a setting pieces episode because that's the big reveal is the cage, which we'll get into as we recap the episode.
Right. The 13 totems. There's always totems. They fucking love totems in this adaptation. The Muschietti's adaptation is like so very totem based, I think, some reason. But before we dive into that, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor. This episode of Watching It, Welcome to Derry is brought to you by Black Magic Design, the makers of the cameras and post-production tools behind some of the most cinematic horror you've ever seen, and one of those companies that actually helped create the It universe with Black Magic's DaVinci Resolve used for post-production on both It and It Chapter 2. And by the way, Chainsaw Award winners and nominees, The Substance, Final Destination Bloodlines, Screamboat Willie, Long Legs, and 28 Years Later, Hollywood level power without the Hollywood price. Learn more at blackmagicdesign.com. Thanks for the sponsorship, guys. And
yeah, thank you.
And yeah, so let's talk a little bit, you know, about the settings here. So the things moving into place. So what we have here is we have a pretty heavy focus on the people of color, I think, in this episode, even more so than the previous. It feels like Lily, the white girl of the story, is kind of her and Marge. They get a moment, but they're kind of all in the background. This is way more focused on the Hanlons. It's way more focused on Ronnie's father and his wrongful imprisonment. You get the Hanlons kind of getting involved in that and trying to help him out. And then you get a big chunk of it. The whole thing ends with kind of a heavy focus on the indigenous peoples' role that they are playing in containing this evil. So it does feel like this one more than the other ones. You get the black spot is being set up. Like this one, I think more than the others are focusing on the people of color in this story.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. Margie and Lily do get, I thought it was a pretty epic moment, pretty horrific moment at the end of this episode. No. But yeah, we're learning more about the setup for the black spot. We see that they're given a decommissioned sort of warehouse garage to clear out the junk and set up their own little party location, their little love shack, whatever you want to call it, by the side of the road.
Right.
And I like that there's even a shout out like, hey, Dick, you could do some cooking in here, which I think is a nice little way of foreshadowing Dick Halloran's future as a hotel chef. And I just recently spoke to Chris Chalk about this performance, and he was telling me, one of the things, this is for a Q&A in Esquire about episode 3, so I didn't get into this because this comes up in episode 4, but this whole cooking thing with Dick, a little bonus I can offer fans of watching It, is he said, being a cook is how Dick Halloran stays a part of things, like how he's a part of the party without being in the party, because it's too noisy to be around people, but he is a very social guy, so he likes being close to it, but he doesn't like being in the middle of it. So if you're the guy throwing the party, if you're the guy creating the banquet, you can kind of keep a little distance. I thought that was an interesting take on Dick Halloran and the future we know is in store for him.
Right. Yeah, no, that is interesting. You know, especially when you notice the more that he's in the forefront, the more he kind of welcomes conflict here. Because there's a mm-hmm. lot of conflict in this one between him and Leroy, where Leroy's kind of fed up with his, you got to tell me what you know, because this shit's starting to really affect me and my family. And that, of course, mm-hmm. all spawns from this little fishing outing, this fly fishing outing that he takes with his son. And and something happens there. And what I actually really like about this sequence is that there's a few moments in these kind of stories that I have kind of little patience for, right? And one of these is built, it's just a baked into the whole point of it, where the kids see stuff and the adults are oblivious. It usually bugs the shit out of me when the kids mm-hmm. see something and the adults just turn a blind eye to it. Now, there is a story reason why that happens here, for sure, mm-hmm. but they sidestep it with this. Leroy actually believes that something is happening to his son. Leroy actually sees the balloon that is floating across the river after his son is attacked, right? There's to me, that was a big surprise in this episode, because I'm used to, especially in this universe, but almost always in horror, kid sees something supernatural or scary. Adults don't see it. They just think the kid's overreacting. They don't believe the kids. That's, you can only pull that so many times before I start rolling my eyes. And so I was actually really surprised that they didn't fall into the same trope, this time.
So why do you think Leroy saw the balloon?
That is a really good question. We've talked a little bit about this, outside of this recording. And, there is the fact that, that he has that brain injury that's affecting his fear, mm-hmm. the fear receptors in his brain or whatever. But I honestly mm-hmm. think it's more, my guess is that for the adults there, it is more about forgetting, and he is in the midst of investigating this thing, right? So I think it's easy for the adults in Derry to forget and turn a blind eye and not see what's in front of their face. Out of sheer will, but he is actively looking for this thing. He knows that there's a weapon, something that produces fear. He knows there's something weird and supernatural going on already, just based on his job. So I think he is more open to seeing the remnants of that. And he sees the balloon twice in this episode. So, and he doesn't pussyfoot around it either. He confronts the powers that be. He confronts the general about it. He confronts Dick Halloran about it. It's like, what exactly are we doing here? Because this isn't, whatever we're poking at is taking notice, and it's coming for me, and it's made a move against my son. So my guess is that it's because he's actively involved in it, and it's not something in the back of his mind.
That's the theory I have.
Yeah.
And we discussed in the last episode. So I agree with you.
Yeah.
In the last episode, we said Pennywise is alarmed by Dick Halloran's using the Shining to find him in his lair, because he's used to, or it is used to, deciding when you see it. Right. And I think Pennywise is revealing himself to Leroy Hanlon, because Leroy is part of this hunt. Mm-hmm. And I think he targets his son, Mike's dad. What's the kid's name?
Will.
Yeah. He targets Will Hanlon by pulling him into that stream and not killing him as a warning sign. Like, he's shaking this guy's, he's like basically putting a gun to this guy's kid and saying, like, you come for me, I'm going to hurt your family. That's a classic mobster tactic, right? Like, you might not worry about yourself, but I'll kill everybody you love. Yeah. And so, I think it's a deliberate play by Pennywise to show itself to Leroy, who's piloting this psychic Dick Halloran around, trying to poke at the edges of what it is. Pennywise is like, just keep away. And so I think it's a deliberate, I think this is a scare tactic. This is a, hey, nice kid, be shame if something happened to him kind of move.
Right. Well, and the General Shaw, makes mention mm-hmm. specifically that what he's interested in Leroy is that should they find this ultimate weapon, his, inability to feel fear in the way that most people do is makes him kind of, my guess is he's being positioned less as a, he's a good pilot around these parts to to carry Dick Halloran around in a helicopter looking, you know, as a portable, you know, GPS pinger or whatever, and more the fact that whenever they corner this thing or find it, that they General Shaw thinks that Will is going to be the reason why they might be able to confront it or contain it. So if that is the case, and Pennywise knows this, if the entity knows this, then of course he's going to want to do anything he can to to shake him in advance. And like the kids make note of that. Like the kids say, it could have killed me. It didn't. You know, Will says it could have killed me at that point. My dad wouldn't have gotten there in time, but it didn't. And, you know, they're using that more to set up the traditional Pennywise thing of like, oh, and, you know, it's a little bit of TV writer bullshit that happens in the scene. No kids are sitting around in a circle going, you know, I once read about the pituitary gland, you know, injecting, fear hormones, and some predators like it more. It's definitely writers explaining shit through dialogue. I'll give it a pass because I like those kids, and it works enough with Will being a bookworm and all that stuff. But it's a little bit writerly bullshit, but... So you could have the thought that he's doing this just to sweeten them up, but they didn't really sweeten up the other kids very much, you know, beyond, you know, in the beginning, in the first episode, they get torn apart in the theater. It's like, we know that they've been affected. They talk about, you know, having seen stuff and being scared. We've seen the lampshade sequence. We've seen some of that effective, but it, you know, Pennywise, as we know him, it's not usually just a you know, a one and done. I guess with the exception, now that I'm saying that out loud, I'm thinking of a couple of contradictions. There's the girl in the bleachers in It Chapter 2. He just pops up and goes, you know what, I'm going to eat you. You know, like there is
It's interesting that Pennywise isn't... I don't think Pennywise is all-powerful. Right. Pennywise is not a terrestrial being like Bruce the Shark from Jaws, where he could just eat you if you happen to be in his lair, in the water with him. I think the fear, it's worth remembering, is a critical component of how Pennywise strikes, because it is a shapeshifter, but he's also almost a ghost, right? Is that there's not like a physical aspect to him, unless you are afraid. That a fear opens the door and allows him to bite into you. And if he doesn't have that, then he can't strike. So it's not like he's just a monster that can go around and kill old people, grown-ups, that sort of thing. He's got to target people whose imaginations will empower him. And that's why he can tear the kids apart in the theater, but he can't really strike General Shaw, can he? Like, you'd think if he didn't want to be found, he'd go, all right, who's leading this hunt? There's Dick Halloran. I'm going to sneak it. I'm going to crawl up through his drain and slit his throat. I'm going to skewer the general on a pike. I'm going to wipe out this whole airbase. Like, Pennywise is not King Kong, you know?
Right.
He needs that fear. And I think that's why his one way of striking at Leroy Hanlon is through his son.
Right.
And that was a kind of cool way of approaching the character. Like, there are rules that they got to follow in that writer's room. And, you know, the thing with you said about the writer, you know, writers explaining some biological backstory and setting some sort of logic through the kids. I don't know. I'm going to push back on that, because kids do like to solve a problem, right? They do get together. You know, I think of it almost like a school project. You sit around and you're like, all right, we got to do this thing about corn. What is the role of corn, since we're a Stephen King show? What is the role of corn in our society, which the Indians call maize, you know?
Right.
There's like, you know, you just throw out every fact that you have about corn production. And I think that's what these kids are doing, is they're grasping at ways to be logical about this creature in order to understand its boundaries.
Right.
So that kind of worked for me. And yeah, I like too. You know, they come up with a good phrase early on when they show the photographs of the, from the cemetery, which when they developed them, showed the ghosts, showed the clown. They take that proof to Chief Bowers to show him that there's something out there. This is the thing that attacked the kids in the theater. Hank Rogan is innocent. And Chief Bowers looks at these photographs, and the only one that shows anything is this hazy shot of what appears to be a clown, which the cops interpret as a, some sort of statue in the mm-hmm. cemetery. But the ghosts are all gone from those images.
Are they gone, so, or did they? It looked to me like they didn't show. They didn't show all the photos because when Charlotte, when Will's mom mm-hmm. finds the stuff, I think that like you can see that one of the photos that she has is like one of the ghost children, correct? And she's like, "What's all this? You know, what's this that you need mm-hmm. in the back?" So it's like, I thought that too, where I'm like, it doesn't look like you showed them all the best stuff, man. It, you know, like where's all the dead kids?
Well, I think they showed them the photos. My theory, and this is what I was going to ask you, is right. why didn't the cops see it? And I think it's because Pennywise could put that veil over your eyes.
Right.
So, again, Pennywise is deciding. It is deciding when it is seen. And so that's what that meant to me, is that you can get the evidence. Yeah. The rules of Stephen King's novel is Pennywise must follow the rules of whatever form he takes. So if he's a werewolf, silver bullets can kill him because that's part of the belief system. Right. And if you believe in a camera's ability to capture this ghost, it's going to capture it. But then Pennywise gets to wipe the board, so to speak, and say, yeah, okay, you got me, but these guys can't see it. So who are you going to show it to?
Well, I mean, even if Pennywise isn't like pulling some interdimensional veil, you know, figurative or literal, you know, it goes back to that belief system. The cops don't believe in ghosts. They don't believe in that stuff. So they're not going to see it. Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that tracks like more than they just forgot and left out all the good shots. So I like that better.
And the kids said, like, maybe he's like Dracula, where you can't see him in a mirror. Like, they're grasping. I love that explanation too. Like, they're going toward the horror monsters that they know,
right?
And using what they know, and there are certain rules to vampires as well, and werewolves, and Frankenstein's monster, and all that stuff.
No. Well, for the most part, the kids take the kid group takes a back seat in this episode. They, like you mentioned, Lily and Margie, they get a hell of a scene, and it's another bullying scene. But I want to kind of save that one for the end because I think that's the juiciest stuff to talk
Literally.
About. gnarly fucking shit there.
There's a lot of juice, a lot of eyeball juice,
a lot of eyeball juice. But it feel the I think I you know I mentioned earlier that I feel like this is moving a lot of pieces. This is a after the action of the last episode. This is a putting the plot forward here. You're getting a lot of backstory explanation. The finale, you know, is a good 8 to 10 minutes of just flashback to mm-hmm. where it came from. You know, this a lot of the rules, a lot of the indigenous peoples, how they dealt with that and how they're still dealing with that.
Yeah.
But then you also get the racial component. You get the injustice of Ronnie's dad in jail. You find out why. You know, he's hesitant to give the full story on where he was that night and, you know, why his alibi is shaky. And you also, on the other side of that, you get more of a familial clash in the Hanlon family. You get Charlotte and Leroy butting heads on how they fight their injustice on their own way. You get Leroy and his relationship with Will in trying to be the good father and how that's not really working out. So it feels like the drama is more centered here. And maybe we should start with the wrongfully imprisoned man, you know, because this has been kind of the C story. It's really gotten crumbs in the previous episode and it's a little bit more on the forefront here.
And Taylor Page's character, Charlotte Hanlon, Will's mom and Leroy's wife, gets to step up and we see a little more. She gets a little more agency and activism, right. Literally activism in this. We find out she was a crusading civil rights activist in the South where they lived. Mm-hmm. She's got a great accent, by the way, just so smooth and mm-hmm. so musical, that great Southern accent. So, you know, she came from somewhere deep down where her people would not be welcome. And she's dealt with a lot of hate, and she confronts Chief Bowers and asks to speak to Hank. He doesn't allow her to, and I gotta say, I don't think Chief Bowers is a good guy, but he is not a stereotypical son of a bitch racist either. I think, like, we know Hank is innocent. We know he's wrongfully accused, but objectively speaking, if you're looking at the evidence, this guy was the projectionist. He's lying about his alibi. They have the cigarette evidence that places him at the scene. I think it's not that he's not being railroaded. In other words, I think there are some things that, like, it's bad luck, but that do place him at the scene, and somebody did this. And I don't think the cops are to blame for not believing it's a psychotic, shape-shifting killer, supernatural clown. Oh, yeah. So I think they're going with the best evidence. And he says, look, this isn't the South. He has access to his attorneys. And I thought that line was interesting. He goes, it's not the South. Meaning, he doesn't think he's racist. He probably is in a lot of ways. It's 1962. Oh, yeah, for sure. But he, you know, when she gets the blessing from Hank's mom to represent his mother and speaking with him, the cops let her do it. And but not without some pressure.
Yeah, she says, say, there's lots of threats there. Yeah.
When she says, I am connected essentially, and if you don't let me in to talk to him, I'm going to bring MLK and JFK and RFK and a bunch of other FKs. I love that line. A bunch of other FKs. I'm like, all right. Do you mean like motherfuckers? Is that what that is? She's going to bring them in. That was like a very cool scene, like where she asserts herself and the guy blinks and he lets her in to talk to him. And she finally gets Hank to admit he's lying about his alibi. And so there is a reason he's being accused, but he won't come clean. And he says essentially he was with a white woman, right? But he doesn't say who.
He does not say who, and he... And it's a very interesting thing because even as you said, this is the more progressive North. Even at this point, him being with a married white woman, married not so much important, the white part being important, means that it's worse than him going to Shawshank, right? It's like what would happen if that got out is worse for him and his family than him going to this place.
Well, he says, I'll go to jail for these murders, but I'll get strung up if I come clean about this. And, right. So what are your theories there, Eric?
Obviously, it's Chief Bowers' wife, right? It's got to be. No, I mean, it might be. I said that as a joke, but that actually, it wouldn't surprise me.
Wouldn't that make sense? Wouldn't that be a wrinkle?
What a twist. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that right now it's less important who it is than, you know, why it makes sense why he's being so cagey and not fighting as much for his freedom. You know, and I also got to say, you talked about this being a good character moment for Charlotte. It's not just that she asserts her power here. It's not so much that she just like, oh, I'm connected, I'm part of the resistance movement, you know, I'm part of the, you know, fighting the equal rights movement. Like, it's not that she's connected. There's also a little bit of smarts at play here, which I really like. She goes back when Chief Bowers is off. And she talks to an underling. I don't think she could have muscled Bowers the way that she muscled the underling, and with threats, because the buck stops at Bowers. Obviously, the councilman and all that stuff we found out, you know, are putting pressure on him. But when it comes to the ability to get in and see this guy, you know, she needed to threaten somebody under him that's like, what's the chief going to think about this when if you make this a bigger deal when I'm obviously in my legal rights to talk to this prisoner?
Charlotte Hanlon is a good tactician. She knows. She knows the right strategy.
She knows it. I don't know. I thought that was I criticized a little bit of the lazy writing earlier about like, oh, here all the kids are just going to explain through a science book what Pennywise is. This to me is like an option. It's an example of a piece of good writing where it's a very. It's another layer on top of what the scene is. It's something that's underneath that you register. It's a powerful moment for her as a character, but you're also, you know, in the back of your mind, you're going, you know, there's something very smart about how she's going about this. And, you know, and how that goes into this confrontation with Ronnie's father. I always forget his name. What did you say his name was? Hank?
Hank Rogan.
Hank. You know, because she She's very kind and there for him, and she explains that, yes, his rights were violated and, you know, the due process wasn't done the way it should have been, and that's really...
She's a good lawyer, too.
She's a good lawyer, but whenever... She also doesn't take any shit, though. That's like, at a certain point, she's like... Like, all right, you got to cut the shit and tell me what's going on. I can't help you with this. You know, there's some tough love there, too. Yeah.
She intuits that he's innocent. I mean, she can sense it. Like I said, the other guys, I don't think they're railroading him, but they're definitely, maybe their racism is coming out, and they're not giving him the benefit of the doubt. They're looking for anything to exonerate him. And they're finding some circumstantial stuff that points the finger at him. And they're just going for that. They're not questioning that. She's questioning that. She's given him the benefit of the doubt, which is what due process is all about. Like, okay, well, like, what is the actual truth here? What does it show? And she's trying to get him to come clean to her about what's actually happened, and he steps forward a little bit. He doesn't give her all the details. I think we'll eventually find out who this other woman is. I got my suspicions, but I don't want to say. I'm afraid I'm right, and I don't want to spoil anything.
Oh.
That's how's that for swagger bragging? I'm not going to say. It's like the... but I think that I like seeing her get active. And you mentioned the natives, native people of Maine. She does have a good scene with Rose as well.
Yes,
secondhand Rose.
Yeah.
And I like that they're establishing a little connection there. Like Rose has the history, and I think you apply the history to somebody like Charlotte, who's ready to step up and also sees that something is off here in the town of Derry.
Yeah.
That could be a powerful allyship.
Well, she's a... If there's one thing that it or Pennywise weaponizes, it's bullying, right? That is the... You know, whether that takes the form of misogyny or racism or homophobia or literal 1950s greasers, as bullies or the patty cakes in as shown in the series.
What a great name for the mean little mean girl squad, the patty cakes.
For sure.
I love that.
Yeah. And Charlotte's somebody who stands up to bullies. She's already been established as somebody who is enraged over injustice, right? The first thing she does, you know, when you see her walking through town is trying to help a kid that's getting picked on, where, you know, even the kindly, not, I swear I'm not racist. We joked about him. Like I would have voted for Obama
Mr.
for a
Kirsch.
Third time. Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Kirsch, the butcher.
The butcher, like even the kindly butcher, like I'm not prejudiced. I think variety is the spice of life. That kind of guy. He's just like, boys will be boys whenever he sees that stuff. And kind of raises an eyebrow that she goes out and tries to stop it. I definitely see Charlotte as being positioned here as, even if they're looking at Leroy as being a weapon against Pennywise with whatever happened to his brainstem, I think Charlotte is representing, you know, the real fight again. This is the real thing that stands up against the evils that Pennywise does.
Yeah, Leroy may have the amygdala bruise or whatever that prevents his fight or flight from kicking in, but Charlotte's the real one who doesn't have any fear. That's a fearless lady, you know? She'll step up to these little punks on the street, tell them to step off, you know? She talks back.
She'll walk into the police station in broad daylight, turning eyebrows and all, you know, getting back to her husband that she's causing trouble again, which causes rifts. And I think she knows she's got a righteousness about her, right? She knows what she's doing is right. The fight is right. And so, you know, you can tell that there's love in that family, that there's respect, mutual respect in that family, but you know, there's also that thing that they just don't see eye to eye on. You know, we talked a little bit about it in previous episodes where it's the do you fight within the system or do you fight against the system? You know, that is a giant divide in a otherwise, I would assume, you know, unified family, right?
Yeah.
It's very
so let's talk about the patty cake scene.
Yeah, okay.
Bathroom scene. Marge is setting up Lily on behalf of the patty cakes to have a humiliating moment, flirting with the handsome young jock.
Right.
You know, the boy that they all got crushes on.
Yeah.
Lily's about to step into that trap, and Marge, who's been kind of a rotten person here and there, She's actually sparked some theories online that she is Pennywise. I think there's something about her hairstyle. Every now and then her glasses catch a reflection of orange light and people are like, oh, that girl's Pennywise. I don't think she's Pennywise. Obviously, this episode reveals she is being tortured by Pennywise in this. But the reason Pennywise steps in to target her is because she's about to not feed Pennywise, right? Like, Pennywise is the cat when you walk by the closet that has the cat food in it and the cat wants to eat. And when the cat realizes you're not responding to her yowling, she's going to bite you on the ankle and get your attention. Pennywise wants the humiliation that Lily is about to experience. And so when he doesn't get it, he strikes out at Marge because she's about to tearfully tell Lily, don't do it. We're setting you up.
Yeah.
And Marge has a hallucination. Do you want to describe the hallucination and its origins? I thought this was a fucking great, creepy, disturbing Pennywise moment.
Right. I mean, we've all seen these kind of things. This is where, like, it's the same kind of shit where that spawned the cordyceps from The Last of Us. It's this whole concept. They're watching this in-school, like, nature video about parasitic worms that get into insects, and then they jut out through the eyes and make these, like, colorful, flashy, giant, like, cone-like protrusions.
Like with a hypnotic kind of light and pulse, color pattern.
The whole idea for these parasites is that it attracts birds from far away, and then the birds eat the bug and then carry the parasite larva, you know, and distribute it around. It's part of the ecosystem. When we're watching that in the classroom with those characters, if you watch, the camera isn't on Marge. She's sitting behind Lily. And Lily's kind of, you know, she's paying attention on it, whatever, but she's not really super affected by it. Marge is. You look at Marge's face behind her, she's just the whole time, she's like, you know, she's having, which is the correct reaction to that footage, which is horrific and disgusting. So,
I mean, there's a great way of setting it up with the science reel, you know, and all I can think of is that the Derry public school system must have invested heavily in these educational videos to scare the living shit out of your students.
Well, there's lots of imagery. There's two of them in this one, and featuring the return of the turtle, by the way, because we see one of the classic, duck and cover.
Nuclear war, duck
Cold,
and cover.
The Cold War duck and cover thing, and not everybody has a turtle shell, you know, like Tommy the Turtle or whatever the fuck his name is. You know, so get under your desk when the bombs fall. They're 16 millimeter projectors getting a lot of use in this school. So they see this video. You're right, and Marge, and I gotta also take a moment to talk about Marge as a character played by Matilda Lawler. She's, I think, doing some of my favorite work in this series. Like, she is by far down the line of my list of my favorite characters, but that's because Matilda's doing such a good job at her, because this is so real. This is, to me, this is the authenticity of adolescent cruelty here. This is exactly how it is. She wants to fit in with someplace. She's trying to bring her longtime friend with her, and just, it won't happen, but she wants to be part of the cool kids club, and that is an allure that everybody feels. That is such a more authentic way into bullying than just my family life is shitty, right? There's something about that rings so true to me, that kind of temptation of being in the cool kids club and doing just a little cruelty here. It's a little Needful Things, right? Where it's like, you're going to get what you want, and oh, you're just doing a pinch of cruelty here. But then that pinch of cruelty escalates to the point where poor Lily's already been back to Juniper Hill, you know, this season, and she is on the precipice of, you know, she's being threatened to go back because she's actually fighting against the evils now and admitting what she's seeing. But so she's already, this poor character's already, you know, kind of on this lip, and if she had been carried here, which is pretty much what would have happened, it's not pig's blood, but it was going to be humiliation in front of the school, that might have been a step too far for this character. And I think Marge realizes that, and I love the conflicted character here. So I know that we started talking about all the fun gore stuff, but I just wanted to take a moment to talk about how much I appreciate the characterization here, the conflicted character of Marge, and how that's being presented.
Before we get to the eyeball thing and how it manifests for her, I want to ask you, do you think that the internet theories about the orange lights reflecting off of Marge's glasses, is that deliberate? Do you think that that is a little signal that the filmmakers, the directors, and the showrunners are sending? Or is that just... That's just the glass. Look, my glasses are reflecting right now, right? So glasses reflect. So is this just the coincidence, or do you think it's a little signal? Like whenever I noticed when she's watching the slugs movie about the parasitic organisms, you know, she has that little or it's an orange glint. It's not a white or blue or whatever.
And nobody else is getting reflection. That color. Is that why the
yeah? And it happens in the hallway when she walks by. Is that a little bit of like Pennywise is in her? Like she is going with the flow. She is doing the patty cakes bidding. Like is she under the spell of it a little bit there? And that's a little signal to the viewer, or is that just just a reflection. It's not anything.
My instinct is that everybody's like pulling a Shining Room, you know, 237 documentary on this and digging too deep and trying to find meaning when there is none. That said, I gotta say, with the payoff to that being something that happens to her eyes, and it's such a sharp focus on her glasses and her eyes, there might be something there. I'd have to look at it. I honestly haven't noticed it. So I'd have to look at it and see like what the light source is and see if it's hitting anybody else. But I could absolutely see them, you know, going, all right, this is just a motif with this character. We are always going to have an orange light, even if it's a subtle thing, and maybe it picks up in her glasses, maybe it doesn't, where it's just representing, you know, the influence of the clown. I could absolutely see that decision being made. But normally I'd kind of write that off. But the fact that you're getting the horrific eye imagery for the payoff to her character might give more credence to that than I normally would give that kind of conspiracy theory, you know?
So then the Pennywise basically starts to fuck with Marge.
Right.
And it starts with the bloodshot eyes. She notices something's wrong with her eyes in the mirror. And you see that those veins start to pop. And then the eyes start to bulge. And this is where my... I was watching with my wife and son, and my wife turns away. And I had seen a few episodes ahead, so I know Marge makes it. Mm. So I was like, oh, it's okay. You can watch this. And then, like, the most horrible thing happens with these bulging eyes pulsing with strange light. And she runs into the shop room, and she's jabbing the eyes with... a little chisel.
Yeah.
And that's bad enough. And I think what happens there is obviously her eyes aren't really bulging, but I think she does damage to her right eye with the chisel. And then she leans down to stick her eyes, her bulging eyes, under, what is that, a jigsaw?
It's like some kind of table saw, right? I mean, she's in like a shop class. She ran into the shop room and...
There's like a long exposed... blade that she starts running, and she leans in with her bugging eyes, and that's where my wife was like, you said I could watch this. Like, she's like, what? I'm not watching this.
Yeah.
Oof. And then you see, like, there is something visceral about your bulging eyes being sliced off by a bandsaw that just fucking freaks me out. It gets under my skin. Like, thanks a lot, Jason Fuchs and Muschietti's for imposing that sensitivity on me. Now I've got that nightmare in my head. Never thought about my eyes getting sawed off.
Listen, the whole concept of parasites is freaky to begin with. I mean, it's natural that they included this, thinking about it, though, because what is Pennywise other than a symbiotic parasite on dairy, right? It's like, if dairy feeds Pennywise, and Pennywise, you know, feeds dairy in a certain way. It's like, you know, there's, you know, it feeds it anger and hate and, you know, bigotry and horrificness. But, you know, they do feed off each other. So
it also, I think whoever wrote this scene or whoever came up with this concept really tapped into something small that we all experience, like a small fear, right? Mm. Not a big fear.
Of dropping a pill into a toilet.
Well, there's that. But losing your son, that's a big fear, right? That's what Leroy Hanlon has. He's terrified of losing his son.
Yeah.
But like the little fear of like, do you ever get like a pimple or a zit or a cyst? Mm. And you're told like, don't pick at it, right? Mm. But you can't help but pick at it. Right. It's like a mosquito bite. If you scratch it, you're going to make it worse. And then you get a scab and you get a little open wound instead of just a mosquito bite that's itchy, mm-hmm. and it still itches. Or a pimple. Like, if you, the worst pimples are the ones that don't pop.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Fucking horrible. Like, if it pops and the pressure's out, like, okay, you could start to get better. Mm-hmm. But if you're just like, oh, I'm just squeezing this thing and it's not getting any better, that's what's happening to our eyes. So they took this little fear that human beings have of like, oh, I can't stop picking at this. They make it the eyes, which is such a sensitive spot. Mm-hmm. And I think like that makes it all the more horrible, because like, you can imagine having a cyst under your eyelid or something, and how awful that would be. You just want it to pop and go away, get it out of there. And now it's actually on your corneas. Your eyeballs are popping out of your skull. Like, ah, this is the worst fear. They really got into something primal. And now I'm going to cut it off. Like, oh, oh. And then poor Lily gets the blame. She saved Marge's ass, man.
She did.
Marge was about to cut her forehead off with that bandsaw.
Yeah, she was going head first into that thing. At first, she just kind of slides her fake parasite eyes across it, and there's lots of blood and all that stuff there, but that's not whenever the glimmer goes away. That's not the damage that was done. The damage was when she was using the chisel, right?
Yeah.
And so Lily saves her ass, and then this gets into one of my other, you know,
but in doing so, she ends up implicated as the attacker, because she's sitting there pulling the chisel out of her hands, and now she's standing there when all the kids rush into the room.
Yeah,
and
looks like her. Yeah, and
crazy Lily lashed out. Looks like.
And yeah, even her friends are like, you know, what am I witnessing here? Because she's just got a bloody chisel in one hand, and Marge is on the ground with one eye gouged out, or whatever the shit's going on there. And this goes into another one of my like storytelling bugaboos that I usually don't like. And listen, it means it's effective that I don't like this, and I will say that right up front. It gets on my nerves so badly when you have a character who keeps ending up being like, oh wait, I'm not crazy, you're just seeing the wrong moment, right? And I'm saying that it bugs me not because it doesn't happen. It bugs me because it does happen, and it like really gives me so much anxiety as a viewer. And like, I just am waiting for that moment where Lily's gonna, you know, fucking have her day and go, aha, I am vindicated in this. And I'm, given the setting of this, given that it's a prequel, I don't know if she's guaranteed that moment. And that makes me all the more anxious for her, but I feel so badly for her. So it sounds like I was going to set up this as a critique. I think they're doing it very well, because I care about this girl, and I care about, you know, her not doing, she's doing everything right and paying a price for it. And I really, it makes me sad for her, and it's giving me a whole lot of anxiety when I'm watching this, going, what's the next time she's going to do something right, save somebody, and then get fucked for it, you know?
Yeah, that's injustice, right? That's part of the story. It is frustrating, though, when you're like, same thing's happening to Hank, right? Wrong place, wrong time. He's up to something else. Sure. He gets blamed for this terrible murder. It's unfortunate. I think that leads us into the finale, which is when we get one of the native guys. I think his name's Jason, right? Am I right about that? What's the name of the guy they get in custody? Who's the handsome, long-haired native man who is prowling around the edge of the airbase? Do you remember the character's name?
I do not. It's somebody that we've seen before, but up until this episode, you know, I think he speaks out a little bit at the town meeting that they have with, you know, the tribal meeting. But
well, he's not Rose's son, right? He's her nephew or something, or cousin.
Yeah. And so Shaw has the idea of like, okay, grab this guy, because this guy's gonna know. He's gonna, it's like these guys, there's like this photo of them like scoping out what they're doing, and I guess Rose is kind of sending him on a wild goose chase of, oh, don't look here, and they're like, oh, we're gonna look there, and of course there's nothing there. But this is how the military, through Dick Hanlon, are gonna find out exactly what the indigenous people know about this evil. And it's another great character thing. I think Dick Halloran is coming out of this so far being like one of the most interesting characters in the whole thing. Like I love how every episode there's something new for me to kind of chew on with that character. And this one in particular, he's a son of a bitch for what he does here. He essentially psychically waterboards this fucking guy, you know, and ends up in his memories. And I want to point out the way that this is portrayed. It's a little Dark Tower-ish, no? A whole series of floating doors in the middle of nothing. I mean, in Dark Tower, it's like in the middle of a forest or on a beach or something. But here, it's against blackness. It's his way into different memories are through just these floating, free-floating doors.
It's a little bit Stranger Things, I think. You know, whenever Eleven goes into somebody's head, she's sort of in a void. Dark void, and there's water on the ground. I don't think that's what he has here, but there's a bunch of doorways he can go through, and he basically ransacks. You mentioned he waterboards him.
Yeah.
He ransacks this guy like a bunch of hoods in a 1930s gangster picture, going through your drawers and flipping over your tables and cutting open your cushions. And he finds this memory of when Rose was essentially testing this young man as a boy about what he, you know, it's sort of like a warning. Like, I love the moment when she goes, you know, some of our stories are stories and some of them are true. And like that to me is like, ooh, that's scary.
Yeah.
So he basically gets the native legend about what this entity is in the Western woods. And they give it a name. They call it the Galoo. Which is a term I'd never heard. I tried to Google it, and I couldn't find that it actually exists. I don't know if it's a made-up term. It's not like the Wendigo in Pet Sematary, which is a real native legend.
Right.
Although
it shares a lot of similarities between the indigenous Wendigo.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, in the book, King calls it a glamour. The only thing that King directly ties it to old folklore is a glamour, which is, you know, glamour, right? And I think that's more of a European like folklore versus an indigenous one. But the Muschietti's have been, you know, kind of really leaning into that. Obviously, there's set up for that in the King novel, because you have the losers doing the little, you know, smoke out, you know, thing in the underground clubhouse to have the vision and to see pretty much what we're seeing here, which is Pennywise coming in on the meteor and all that stuff. Yeah, but
correct me if I'm wrong, but they do that because they say this is like a native technique, right?
For sure.
Knowing the past. And so King,
and remember,
didn't
Mike
really
Hanlon
get
also like has the like drum or whatever that's supposed to be able to capture him and all that stuff. Yeah,
you know, King didn't really get into what the indigenous people of Maine thought of Pennywise, but I think, and I'm a little bit averse to fan fiction and any kind of expansion on his stuff. I prefer fidelity to embroidery, but I actually really liked this take. I liked hearing the native myth about Pennywise, the myth that explains the reality. And it reminded me, so they did take something directly from the book, which is, I think it's Ben, right? In that smokehouse situation, sweat lodge kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He sees this sort of meteorite falling through the sky and crashing into Derry, and that's the origin of Pennywise. Very controversial scene in the book, because I think people hate the idea that Pennywise is an alien, right? And one of the people who hates the idea that Pennywise is an alien is the producer, Barbara Muschietti, who, when we had Barbara and Andy on the King cast, Andy very casually is like, you know, he's an alien. And Barbara's like, he's not an alien. And I think what Andy meant was he's this other thing, right? But she's like, he's not an alien. And they had a little brother-sister like disagreement about that. He's not an alien in the sense of like flying saucers from Mars and things like that. It's more like he's this alien from another plane of existence. I think King says he comes from a void. And I feel he's an alien in the sense that Satan is an alien. Mm. Lucifer also falls to earth, right, in a fireball. Mm-hmm. And the devil works a lot like Pennywise. And so You know, he's urging people to indulge their dark sides, nourishing himself off of that. And so I don't see him really as a space alien, as a alien in terms of just an outsider from some other realm of existence who is taking shape here. He's outside of time. He's outside of space. He doesn't obey the laws of our physics. He can shapeshift. He can become what we imagine, and no one else can see it except us. He can get it in our heads. There's almost a telepathic angle to him, like he exists on another plane than what we're in, and yet his radio signal is coming through. So what did you think about that, the way this was depicted, this sort of prehistoric Pennywise with the shards? We saw the shards, too, in the movie version of It and It.
Yeah, in the final layer, you know, that kind of obsidian, you know, sharp obsidian rock, like the anti-Fortress of Solitude that he lives in.
Yeah, the splashdown.
The splashdown, that's, you know, you understand now after this episode that it's a remnant of the thing that he crashed to Earth in, that also the indigenous peoples were using as a weapon against him and a weapon to contain him, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, I think that him crashing down in the time of the dinosaurs, I wish we would have seen him and dinosaurs. Like that was one of the fun bits in the book, where it's like, yep, yeah, like I think there's like some herbivores like munching on something and sees the meteor coming in or whatever. Like what does Pennywise show up to a dinosaur? Like what's it with dinosaur? It's just a bigger
dinosaur
that's got button nose or something. I don't know. That would have been fun. I don't have a problem with him crash landing on Earth. That's all in the text. I don't have a problem either with because the indigenous people would have been the first people. And I do kind of like that it underlines the whole white people fuck everything up, right? Because the indigenous people, like, oh, we let it have its woods and it stayed where it was and we stayed where we were. And then the white people show up and hunt in the forbidden woods and fuck
the indigenous folks learn the hard way too, because part of the myth is that the kids go in, you know, they take that blade, they go in, they're going to stalk this thing, and then the grown-ups come in after them and they end up getting taken down by it.
But that's after the settlers had come in and disrupted the balance, right? So
okay.
So you know.
Oh, but I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this is an interesting point, and I don't think this was really fully explored by King, but it matches with King's logic. Is as long as we starve this thing, it can't grow.
Right.
It's stuck in the woods. So they have the one blade they made from its shard, and Pennywise, like in the time of dinosaurs, I don't think you can really scare a walnut-brained creature apart from I'm a bigger predator. But I don't think that's the worst thing that can happen to a dinosaur, getting eaten, you know, getting stuck in a tar pit or a bog pit, something like that.
Right.
Probably worse. But I think what happens is the notion that Pennywise has no one to scare, Pennywise is just withering, sort of like a seed, right, that goes unfertilized in the ground. It's just waiting there in a little cave for something to come knock it into the ground and for it to connect with some nutrients and grow.
Right.
And so when the settlers come in and the natives are like, yo, stay out of here, and the Europeans are like, well, yeah, everybody says stay out of here. We hear that a lot. Like, we're gonna go take it anyway. I love that notion.
Yeah.
And then the natives are like, okay, we got to fix this by creating the cage.
Yeah,
I dug that as an origin, part of Pennywise's origin.
No, that makes a lot of sense, and it also makes sense because, you know, the first peoples, of course, would be the first things that would have to deal with this evil. And I also like that they're, you know, it might be a little stereotypical of like, oh, you know, the indigenous people are one with the land and they know, you know, they speak with nature and all that stuff. It might be a little stereotypical, but it's also a good thing. I don't know, it's a good stereotype to be like, okay, we know how to live with this thing. Right, this evil, we know that it can exist over here, and there's got to be balance in nature. There's got to be predators and prey. There's got to be, time to harvest and a time to, you know, to sow. Right. I do like that, you know, tying it directly, especially since, you know, Maine and that part of like Canada, what would be, you know, Canada and all that stuff, was, you know, highly populated by indigenous people. So of course that makes sense. And I also like that the evils that it shows to these people. First, it's, you know, a giant moose, when it's a really cool moose where it's kind of shedding the antlers. So it's got that bloody, which is gnarly, you know. Anyway, deers do it, you know, it's the velvet comes off and it's just like hanging rotting flesh, right? Off of this.
Yeah.
Giant
it's like
moose.
It's a wild, it's a diseased wild creature you
thing.
Know, like almost like a rabid, you'd be afraid of a rabid wolf, but that's a little obvious. So like, how about a mad moose? I would not like to be stampeded by a giant fucking moose that throws me around with its antlers.
Right. So I like how that morphs into the colonizers. Like when whenever you're talking at this point where they essentially in the flashback we're shown, they decide we're getting the fuck out of here. It's like we got to leave. Like the white people are screwing it up for everybody. We got to get out of here. And it's the youth that go and say, no, this is our home. What we can do is fight this thing. We got to need more shards of its cage. Like just the one blade isn't enough to hold it back any further. It's too strong now.
We got to lock it up. We got to lock it up.
And then that's when the adults follow them, when they realize that the kids are in over their heads, which is again a great thing. Cause normally in these stories, the adults, these stories are about the old sacrificing the young and turning the other eye to it. And that's not what these people do. They put themselves in danger, and in danger they are. That pretty much everybody gets wiped out except for these kids. It's the youth. It's that generation are the survivors of what happens here. Pennywise takes out all the old warriors, and what's left are the youth to imprison it, which is, again, very interesting, since who does Pennywise always target? The youth. Maybe this is the origins of that. You have the one side of it where they have the imaginations, so they are the ones that feed it the most directly, but they're also the ones that can hurt it. It's never adults that hurt it. It's always the kids. Except in when the losers grow up, but we'll talk about that one later.
You know, you talked about like, oh, you know, maybe the stereotype of the natives who know, you know, a legend about this land, but that's a true thing. Like you live anywhere long enough, you learn from experience over generations.
It's not about knowing the legends. I think the stereotype is that like, oh, all indigenous people are one with nature and they, you know what I mean? It's like that thing where they eat the full buffalo kind of thing, which is a little bit of a white guy's, you know, knowledge of indigenous culture. But
you know, there's a true story I heard that I really love, and I looked it up after watching this episode because I was like, what were the specifics of that?
Right.
I've heard it a couple of different ways, but in Australia, there were colonizers who came in the 1600s, early 1700s from Europe, and you know, they encountered the Aboriginal people there, and there's an area called Kakadu in the northern part of Australia, where the indigenous folks said, there's a dragon, a sleeping dragon here, and you don't want to go digging in this territory. Like, you guys are drilling holes and pulling out gems and precious metals and oil, you know, things that you need, but you don't want to do that. You don't want to disturb this sacred ground where a sleeping dragon rests, or what the Europeans interpreted as a dragon, some sort of monster that will curse you, burn your flesh, and cause all sorts of death and madness and destruction. And again, the European colonizers were like, okay, that's a fun story. We're going to go take this valley, and we're going to dig, and we're going to do what we feel like. And the reality was, there is raw uranium in this land. And so the natives, the Aborigines, learned, probably through their own mining and digging, that if you disrupt this land, you suddenly develop sores. It must be cursed, because they don't have the knowledge of radioactivity. But there's an actual scientific explanation for what this sleeping dragon is.
Right.
And if you disrupt it, you will invoke a curse. And I think this is the reigning theory about King Tut's tomb and Egyptian tombs as well. You know, the myth of like, you open the tomb and therefore a curse is unleashed. All of this strange death starts to happen around you. Some of that is coincidental. Other times it's like, I don't know, you die by some means that science can't explain. And it's because they had artifacts made out of yellow cake uranium buried with these mummies. Mm-hmm. And so there's radioactivity in those tombs that's unleashed when you open up the tomb, and that is the curse, right? That is the thing. And it's not magic, it's science. Mm-hmm. And so I love the idea that there's this myth that is being used to explain something that is real. Maybe not scientific, but maybe there is a science to Pennywise. And the natives are doing exactly what the U.S. Air Force is doing, trying to understand it, trying to control it. They're just doing it in a different way with different means. And so I really love this origin story. I think it's rooted in reality. It's rooted in actual stories and stories that are rooted in truth.
Right. And, you know, the button on all this is, once again, Turtle Watch. What do they bury the shards in to mark the edge of mm-hmm. its territory? Turtle shells. They put the shards in turtle shells and they bury the turtle shells. Mm-hmm. You know, so that, once again, turtles, baby, and turtles are all over this fucking show. I love it.
Turtle power.
And that's where the Ninja Turtles came from, all from Derry, Maine.
I got to give my wife a shout out too. I told you last episode some of her observations, and we're watching it again. And she goes, "I love that this story is also recounted by a child." Mm. When Dick Halloran is picking the brain of this guy, he's a grown man there in the interrogation room, but it's a story of a child telling the legend to his aunt that delivers it to us, the audience, we the audience, and I kind of dug that. Kids have power in the It universe.
Well, they do. And this moment, once again, this is where Dick Halloran steps across the line a couple of times in this. One, doing the interrogation as forcefully as he's doing it in the first place, which is very good. It's like really cool. He does this weird thing with his hands where he's like getting into his mind, and then he like moves his hands like in front of his eyes and has this like mm-hmm. almost like, it's almost like talismanic. You know, mm-hmm. like doing a witchcraft with his hands or something. It's like he's doing something really specific mm-hmm. to show, you know, I'm really pushing this time. But then when he shows up actually in the child's memory.
Yeah, he rises up behind the aunt whose eye has blinked. One eye has blinked and it's like, oh, shit. Didn't you think like, oh, no, Pennywise is coming out. Like you forget you're in a memory. And I'm like, oh, my God, what's happening to this lady? Is she Pennywise? And then he rises up, and he has the most fucked up expression. Mm-hmm. Chris Chalk is an intense-looking guy. He's got really sharp facial features, mm-hmm. sharp cheekbones, intense eyes, very heavy emotional eyes. Mm-hmm. And when he comes up, man, he looks crazy. His eyes are mad.
If you put him in a clown outfit, like you could have swapped him out, man. It's like it's his turn to become Pennywise in this moment, which is really interesting.
He enters reluctantly, right? The guy spits in his face, which is a fucked up thing to do, and he's like, okay, well, I guess we're going to do this the hard way. I'm really sorry about this. Yeah. And I feel like he means it, but man, once he gets in there and starts rooting around in the guy's memory drawers, I think he starts to get intoxicated by it.
There's
and that
some
expression
glee.
Shows me.
Yeah.
I wrote a little note like, is Halloran evil on the my little scrap paper as I was watching the episode. And it started to make me rethink Halloran. Like in The Shining, is he setting that kid up? He's telling him it's just pictures in a book, don't worry. Is he disarming this kid when he should be like, yo, you need to like get the fuck out of here? Instead he's like, oh, it'll be okay, it'll be okay. And then, I don't know, it made me really question, is there a malevolent side to Halloran? He always seems like Mr. Nice Guy, an avuncular sweetheart of an old man. I don't know, man. I'm not so sure.
I mean, you After know, power corrupts, man, and this is him actually getting to unleash his full power. You know, it's like, yep. I can see it being, you know, it's like a drug, I guess, in a certain way, or you mm-hmm. know, falling into alcohol. You can be a great drinker, but, you know, you're not going to be the best person once you fully indulge. And I feel like, you know, there's a little bit of a power trip he's going on, but there's also some selfishness going on as well, because he is doing all this because he gets these little treats from the higher ups. He gets the black spot. He gets his little area that's just for him and his friends to have a bar and gamble. They talk about gambling and music. Yeah. This isn't just like, oh, this is a little, you know, bunk for us where we can just hang loose. This is like, no, this is going to be our like sinner's style, you know, juke joint, right?
Juke joint, yeah.
And it's, you know, and he's doing this evil stuff because he's getting the little pellets from the higher ups, right? He is playing their game in a way that, you know, as we talked in, I think, last episode, where he was judging Leroy Hanlon for playing the game. And he's doing it probably to arguably much worse point.
Very, very transactional. Just to wrap things up, if I can do a little self-plug.
Sure.
I did an interview with Chris Chalk for Esquire.com. You can find it. It's all about the secrets of Dick Halloran and all the things that he put into this character. And we talked about these moments. And a moment you see early in this episode when he sees his grandmother again in the woods. Mm-hmm. And what I love is Chris, the way he plays Halloran, he plays him a bunch of different ways. Mm-hmm. He's a dick to Leroy. He doesn't trust Leroy. He is a very good soldier to the general. He's much more respectful to the general than he is to Leroy.
Right.
And he's a different guy with the boys that he's hanging out with in the tent playing cards, or that he's setting up the Black Spot juke joint with. And he told me, yeah, Halloran has noises in his head all the time, and he likes the noise of these guys because they don't think heavy thoughts. They're just fun dudes. They're just... it's his buddies, and the things they think about are women and music and drinking and playing cards, and like it's all comfort food for him. But when he sees his grandma, the way he plays it is like a 4-year-old. His arms are at his side. He looks like a little boy,
right.
You know? And grandma's warnings are to be heeded. Grandma only appears, I think, when Dick Halloran digs too deep. That's one of the things he told me in this story. So if you're interested in Chris Chalk and his take on this, he also said you could read this story over at Esquire. And he also said he was talking about drawing comparisons to Scatman Crothers, you know, and physical comparisons. He said, you know, Scatman's bald in The Shining. He goes, he proposed to Andy Muschietti and Jason Fuchs that what if you shave my head and give me the, you know, the sort of ring of hair, the male pattern baldness, even at this age, that draws a little more similarity, shows he was bald even back as a young guy. And Andy rejected this. He goes, I'm glad he did. Can you imagine me having to spend a, you know, 9 months with the Sherman Helmsley haircut? I'm like, yeah, that wouldn't have been as attractive, maybe.
Not so much.
He looks pretty good in this show, so that probably would have cut back on that. But he's like, yeah, and he's also like, I'm an older guy. Maybe it wouldn't grow back. But anyway, little self-plug there. If you want to hear more about Chris Chalk and this performance, I really love digging into it with him and getting into who Dick Halloran is. And we're going to see a lot more going forward of just who this fellow is and how he thinks of himself.
Great, yeah. And also, speaking of going forward, the final button on this is... after you see the flashback, you have the native gentleman whose memories are being invaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is forced to show Dick. He's like, all right, here's the way to get at it. And once again, revealing a very familiar house to those who love the It movies, the It book. The house on Neibolt Street, of course, is, you know, we already knew this. We've seen the first couple of movies. We've read the book. The Neibolt house is the entrance to the cave system where these artifacts are buried. So, I would imagine that means we're going to be getting some haunted Neibolt house action in the next, episode or two. So
I'm looking forward to it. I'm interested in, the 19 made that shot made me go, okay, the Neibolt house, even in the '60s, is a pretty ramshackle, torn down place. I think we got some origin in the movies that the reason the Neibolt house is cursed is because it's the site of this well, which would have been like a settler pioneer kind of well that opens up Pennywise's, it just so happens to go down into Pennywise's lair. So that's why the house. I'm wondering about season 2 of Welcome to Derry that rolls back the clock to the 1930s and the Bradley gang. Are we going to see the Neibolt house when it's in tip-top shape?
I think we will. I mean, I think that there's, and it might just
who's living there?
It might just be a nod to Mr. Neibolt, of course. No, it's on Neibolt Street, I know.
Well, it's on Neibolt Street, yeah.
But it would be funny. The street's named after them, of course. I think in the intro, in that really cool, like, Norman Rockwell-y postcard art intro, isn't there, like, a really nice version of the Niebolt house, and Pennywise is kind of in the window, and the kid, like, looking back, scared at it, and the family's taking, a picture, like, one of those old, like, 1930s camera with the flash bulbs, like the press flash bulb pictures?
Yeah. I'd like to see that house, and so what's it like living there?
Yeah, yeah.
What's it like living on top of the dragon, you know?
Exactly. Well, I think we're going to get our answer, especially considering that the show is doing extremely well in the ratings. It's already been approved for 2 more seasons, and you know, we got 4 more episodes left to go in this one. So I think we're just kind of scratching the surface. We're getting a lot of the backstory here in this episode, and I'm hoping that we're hitting the ground running, because I really do feel like you can get us halfway through and only glimpse the clown, but you're going to have to show that fucking clown sooner than later. And I'm saying this, I am completely, I'm an Welcome to Dairy virgin from here on out. This is the last episode that I've seen in advance. So, you know, while we're recording this and talking about it, I have no idea what's happening next episode. So,
we'll find out soon.
Yeah, we'll find out along with you. So hopefully you will join us while we're watching it. Welcome to Dairy.